beetroot juice, used by Olympic athletes for its stamina-boosting effects, caused waves at the last Olympics. Clinical studies prove 2 glasses of beetroot juice per day could increase stamina by 16%. I've been using it, and this product is excellent. Beets are a nutrition goldmine, so call 800-738-2198 or go to intelligentbeets.com. Get a 30-day supply free. That's 800-738-2198 or intelligentbeets.com.
Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today's subject is sex and sexuality. We're talking about a new book called Recoupling, A Couple's Four-Step Guide to Greater Intimacy and Better Sex, whose co-author is Dr. Mohit Khera. He's an MD, he's an MBA, and an MPH. He's all kinds of initials. He's also Associate Professor of Urology at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, and he's Director of the Laboratory for Andrology Research. Andro sounds like Greek for male, so all things regarding male sexual function, testosterone, that's up his alley. He's written lots of scientific papers on this, and in part one, we discussed issues related to the safety and effectiveness of testosterone and strategies for overcoming male ED. But it's also important to maintain parity in this space race of sorts, you know, like when the U.S. And Russia competed for the conquest of space. Similarly, if there's a great deal of disparity between one partner and another, and it can occur either way, there's trouble brewing for a marriage. So, Dr. Khera, what about female sexual dysfunction? How can we address that?
Well, I think it's important to set the tone here for a second. So realize that 43% of women, significant 43% of women, suffer from some degree of female sexual dysfunction. And how do we define female sexual dysfunction? Well, female sexual dysfunction is really 4 categories. There is low libido, there's arousal disorders, there's orgasmic disorders, and then there's dyspareunia, pain with intercourse. And a woman has to have one or a combination.
Wait, it sounds more complicated than guy problems.
Absolutely. You know, female sexual dysfunction, you know, there is, and even the treatment, it's a little bit more detailed. But I was going to mention, the key thing is she has to have a level of bother associated with it. Why is that important? Let's say she says, "Doctor, I have low libido, but I really don't care."
Yeah.
Well, then she really doesn't suffer from female sexual dysfunction.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because otherwise, we in this society, we create a very high bar for, the sexual Olympics. And for some people, possibly to a greater extent for women than for men, but for men as well, sometimes they're sort of resigned to, that's not happening for me. And maybe they shouldn't be made to feel guilty, bad. Or, you know, they watch Dr. Oz and they say, Dr. Oz says, well, I have sex with my wife 3 or 4 times a week. And then they feel bad because they don't.
Right. You're absolutely right. It has to be correlated with a level of bother.
So you mentioned these 4 different categories.
Right. So then they get more interesting. You realize that there are 26 drugs right now, 26 drugs to treat men for sexual dysfunction. There are 0 for women. 0. And we have something pretty exciting going on right now. I'm not sure if you're aware. In the media about 2 months ago, the headlines were female Viagra was approved or just was approved. Supported by the FDA advisory panel. So the FDA has set up an advisory panel to investigate a new drug called Filbanserin. Filbanserin is a drug that works by neurotransmitters.
Excuse me, help us out by spelling it. It's Filbanserin, F-I-L-B-A-N-T-S-E-R-I-N, Filbanserin.
And I'm going to give you the exact spelling here in just a second here. Give me 1 second.
They got to come up with a better name. Maybe we should have a contest to come up with a better name.
F L I B A N S E R I N.
Okay, Filbanserin. Okay.
Right, and it was originally a drug started by Boehringer Ingelheim in Germany, then bought by a company called Sprout here in the U.S. That it had some challenges getting through the FDA, but recently. The FDA set up an advisory panel, and they voted 18-6 to pass it. Now, typically, the FDA agrees with their advisory panel, and on August 19th of this year, which is coming up, a final decision will be made. So I suspect there'll be a lot of media surrounding this announcement, whichever way it goes.
But there may be some political considerations here, too, because, you know, there was a lot about women's equality. And when the score is 27-0, you know, maybe they're going to err a little bit on the side of acceptance of this, even if it's not, 100%.
I don't know. I think, you know, the FDA, you know, is really takes safety and efficacy very seriously. And I think that, you know, there may be some political pressure, but the reality is that, you know, they are very concerned about safety and efficacy. And if it wasn't safe or it wasn't efficacious, then I think that despite the political pressures, they wouldn't pass it, you know?
Well, that's good news then. That's actually good news because
that's good news.
Yeah.
And but I do think that the drug, you know, is efficacious. I do think it's safe. And I think that the advisory panel found the same thing. Now, there may be some restrictions on the usage and who can prescribe it, and that may occur.
Well, how does it actually work? What's the mechanism?
Because it works, but it's really neurotransmitters, serotonin, norepinephrine, and it basically increases a woman's desire for intercourse. And so, you know, the key thing you have to realize is that many women who've taken this medication have seen a significant increase in sexual desire over placebo. And it's pretty compelling, some of the stories of women who have said that it's really changed their lives. They want to have an increased desire at sex, but they don't, and it's affected their marriages. And the medication has helped them tremendously. And so the hopes are is that the FDA will also agree and approve it. Now, if it does get approved, I do think that it will also open up a lot of opportunities for other drugs to treat women for FSD. You know, this may be the first, but it will open up a gateway, a mechanism to allow other drugs to be passed.
Just like Viagra. But, you know, I guess it kind of proves the old adage, which is that a woman's major sex organ is her brain. It's not in the genitals.
Right.
It's in the brain.
Right. But believe it or not, a lot of, even in men, to be honest with you, erectile function has a huge psychosocial and psychological component. And even orgasmic function in men, delayed orgasmia, premature ejaculation, it's a huge, you know, psychologically, the brain has a huge impact. It's really not really discussed much when we talk about men, but it has a huge impact.
But the truth of the matter is that women can take Viagra, and except for a very small minority, there's not much of a plumbing effect, even though there is, in women, erectile tissue. It plays much less of a role in sexual response than in men.
Right, although it does help with arousal to some degree, you know, so it may in some women improve the blood flow to the genitalia, increase lubrication, and increase the stimulation of the clitoris. So it may help in some women, but you're right, there is a discrepancy in effects between men and women.
How about testosterone for women? Because, as you said, there's no approved medication for female sexual dysfunction, and surely testosterone was up for consideration for that indication. In other words, that's a drug, and it's the same testosterone for men as for women. It's the same substance, but it does have an indication for men, but doesn't have an indication for women because they never had sufficient evidence to show that it really, really does the trick.
Right. Well, I think the first time that it was about to get passed was 2003, and there were some phase 3 trials. Procter & Gamble had a drug called Intrinza, which was available at that time, and they were trying to get it through the U.S., and that drug was then didn't pass because right at the 2003, the Women's Health Initiative came out and said that, you know, estrogen causes breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the FDA was really averse to passing any hormones for women.
Right.
But realize now that testosterone is not FDA-approved for women. It's currently used off-label and used in compounding pharmacies.
Yep.
That's how we make it. But it does significantly improve sexual desire in women, and I prescribe quite a bit of it. Many of us do, off-label.
Mm-hmm.
And typically we have
so do I.
Cream.
I do prescribe it as well, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it does often work.
And it does work. I mean, Yeah, it works, and it works quite well in many women, and it does significantly improve their libido and sexual desire, and we find it to be very beneficial.
And so what about side effects and the potential for causing cancer? A lot of women very wary about taking
right.
testosterone, but then other potential side effects or problems.
Right, so there's a risk for hirsutism, and there is a risk for acne. As I mentioned, facial hair, there is deepening of the voice that can occur. But these are really at super physiological, very high levels.
If you give too much, for example.
If you give too much, well, exactly. So we start low. We may use 4 milligrams per ml. We may slowly go up slightly on the dose.
Beautiful. That's exactly what I use. Exactly what I use. Yeah.
Yeah, and typically, but, you know, there's no data to support that testosterone causes any type of cancer in women at this point. There were some initial studies suggesting that testosterone may even be protective against the development of breast cancer. But you know, obviously, larger studies need to be done. But, you know, we have excellent data on our transgender population, where we have patients who are, you know, from female to male, and they will get high doses of testosterone, 10 times the normal dose,
mm-hmm.
with no significant increase.
Yeah, so that would really be the acid test for that, is because they're not just taking a little bit. They really want to change their sexual characteristics from female to male, taking much higher doses, and they don't seem to have such problems.
And we don't see a significant increase in any types of cancers, per se.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we just have to watch Caitlin and, you know, see how that goes.
That's right.
Actually, that's the opposite direction. All right.
That's right.
So now you make a very interesting point in your book about the relationship between obesity and sexual functioning. And this is a little factoid I never had heard, but it's quite fascinating. You write that after bariatric surgery, It has actually been found that some women and some men become hypersexual. So shedding all the weight, it sort of unleashes their sexual desire, which I think is kind of a teaching moment for how to improve your sexual desire and performance for the ordinary population.
Absolutely. Well, there's two mechanisms for this. One, we know that fat aromatizes testosterone and estradiol. And so we know that when you have a significant reduction of fat body composition, you will increase your testosterone levels, and which will in itself increase your libido and sexual desire. We also know that your body image significantly improves. I mean, if you shed 100 pounds, the patients feel more attractive. They are getting more attention, and they tend to want to engage in more sexual activity. So the body image improvement and the increase in hormones both will significantly increase a patient's desire for sex.
Well, that's really, I think, a very important take-home message. You know, when we talk about natural treatments for ED and FSD, is that a program of diet and exercise that achieves significant weight loss, with or without bariatric surgery, can improve things. That's been demonstrated.
Absolutely.
I wanted, in the final moments that we have, talk a little bit about a lifestyle issue related to the risk of prostate cancer. And I recently wrote about natural treatment of prostate cancer, and we talked about diet, we talked about certain supplements, we talked about exercise. Of course, all those have an impact on the risk of prostate cancer. But I came across one which I found kind of interesting, which is the relationship between sex and prostate cancer. And that's been controversial. Some studies initially pointed, the more sex you had, maybe you get sexually transmitted disease, you have more prostate cancer. But now the science pretty conclusively come down in favor of more sex, less prostate cancer, right?
Right. So I think that you have to be very careful when you're trying to decipher between causality and association.
Okay.
If you're saying that, patients who have more sex are less likely to have prostate cancer, I think that you have to be very careful. There may be an association there, and the association may be bidirectional. In other words, patients who have more sex may be healthier in the sense that, and they may therefore have a decreased risk for developing any type of cancer. But I think that it's the data to suggest that having more sex will decrease your risk for prostate cancer, and showing that as a direct link, I think is weak. I think there may be an association, but I can't really promote saying having more sex at this point will decrease the risk for prostate cancer.
It's a little bit like, people who exercise intensely die less, but that's maybe because they're able to exercise more. So it's a little hard to separate that out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And finally, there's a notion that you talk about in your book. You know, we talk about, you know, somebody has a stroke, somebody has a broken leg. I broke my leg a few years back and I went through intensive rehab and now I'm back, you know, fully functional. There is such a thing as penile rehabilitation. And I think we need to talk about it because so many men are undergoing prostate surgery for prostate cancer and they're having sexual problems. But there is such a thing as you can get your mojo back through a program of PR, penile rehab.
Absolutely. Penile rehabilitation, we call it erectile preservation. So, yes, we do quite a bit at my institution. We recover these men from after radical prostatectomy. I tell them to think of it as they've been through a major injury. If you got in a car wreck and you got out of the car wreck, we would try to rehabilitate. We would try to get penile blood flow and exercising. We're trying to get exercise the muscles, excuse me. So same concept with the penis. You know, it's basically taking an injury, a hit. And so with many things we do, give them daily PDE5 inhibitors. We will have them use a vacuum erection device. We will ask them to use urethral suppositories 2 to 3 times a week.
That's a so-called MUSE system, M-U-S-E.
Exactly, M-U-S-E. And we ask them to start having sex at 1 month after surgery quickly. We also treat the female partner. We found that those men who have wives are more likely to engage in sexual activity, tend to recover faster than those patients that don't have wives or partners that want to engage in sexual activity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a program to help speed the recovery of the erectile function as well as to improve the erectile function, and we find it to be very beneficial.
So final question. We talked earlier about the relationship between, you know, the safety of testosterone in relationship to heart disease. What about the safety in relationship to prostate cancer? A lot of, again, doctors and men very chary about initiating testosterone replacement therapy because, prostate cancer looms, the PSA might start going up, and there you go.
Right.
What's the deal?
So it's interesting you say that because, you know, if you said to me, please show me the study that shows that testosterone increases risk for prostate cancer, I would not be able to produce it. If you look at every meta-analysis and you look at those men that get testosterone, there's not been a single study to show that those men getting testosterone have an increased risk for developing prostate cancer. And those men not taking testosterone, not a single study. So what I will tell you now is that, you know, the largest series in testosterone after radical prostatectomy is my series where we looked at men who got a radical prostatectomy and gave them testosterone. That wasn't a randomized placebo-controlled
trial. Some urologists, they don't want to do that because, they've already had prostate cancer. We don't even mess with testosterone, but you have studied that relationship.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And we studied the relationship and we've shown that those men that get testosterone have not had an increased risk for developing prostate cancer, although, again, it wasn't a randomized placebo-controlled trial. But we are doing a tremendous amount of studies here, you know, looking at the effects of testosterone in prostate cancer. I recently published a study in the Asian Journal of Andrology showing that higher levels of testosterone in petri dishes of prostate cancer cells causes an inhibition of prostate cancer cell growth, almost the opposite.
Wow.
And we published that several months ago this year. So, you know, I think there's a lot to learn. This started as a myth in 1941 when Huggins and Hodges reported that giving testosterone causes prostate cancer. And if you pull that article from 1941, you'll find something very interesting. It's based on one single patient.
One patient.
In 1941. And this is where it started. So I can't say to you that, I think more studies need to be done. And, if you said, show me the study that shows that it is completely safe, I can't produce that because there is not a randomized placebo-controlled study saying that it's safe. But on the same breath, you cannot show the article that shows that it's dangerous as well. And what does that mean? You know, we really do need more studies.
Well, that's very reassuring news. And, of course, the caveat is that men who get testosterone should be under the supervision of a urologist to do the digital rectal exams, to monitor the PSA, if necessary, to do additional studies, ultrasounds and imaging studies, just to make sure that things are okay. But as long as you're vigilant, it can be administered very safely. I think you would agree.
Absolutely.
Great. Okay, well, good stuff. And so what's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? Get your book. Tell us about how they can obtain the book.
Well, there's several ways to do it. The easiest way is on Amazon.com. And again, the book is called Recoupling, but Amazon is probably the easiest way to get the book.
Okay, and the tagline is A Couple's Four-Step Guide to Greater Intimacy and Better Sex. the author, today's guest, Dr. Mohit Khera, along with Mary Jo Rapini. And is there a specific website for you?
Well, mine's basically at the Baylor website, so it's www.bcm.edu, BaylorCollegeOfMedicine.edu, where they can look up my information, and then you have Mary Jo's as well, www.maryjorapini.com.
And do patients come to see you from other parts of the United States? Because we have listeners all over the United States and all over the world. Do they come to you specifically for addressing addressing sexual problems and testosterone-related issues?
Absolutely. And we've had patients from outside the country as well come in to see us, and we're always happy to see them.
All right. And Houston's not a bad place to visit except this time of year in the midsummer.
That's right.
Plan a trip in fall, winter, or spring. Okay. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Mohit Khera. The spelling is K-H-E-R-A. That's the last name, the first name, M-O-H-I-T. Thank you, Dr. Khera, for joining us. And thanks for your very, very innovative research in a field that I think is often too much ignored. But is really a vital part of overall health. So great stuff.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.